Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast, where we explore cutting-edge strategies to keep teams human-centered, drive innovation, and empower you with the tools and insights needed to help your team excel and thrive in today's changing world. Your host is Dane Groeneveld, a seasoned expert with over 20 years of experience enhancing team dynamics and innovation. Today, Dane is joined by Dr. Vijay Pendekar. Vijay has reinvented himself from university educator to corporate executive to entrepreneur, building deep expertise in navigating disruption. As founder of Vijay Pendekar Consulting and author of the best-selling book, The Alchemy of Talent, he enables organizations to turn disruption into a competitive advantage, building teams that are more adaptable, innovative, and resilient under pressure. In their conversation, they'll explore why teams, not individuals, have become the real engine of performance, what causes them to get stuck, and simple human-centered behaviors that build trust, resilience, and agility in the face of nonstop change. It's a practical, energizing look at how leaders can help their teams navigate disruption with clarity and confidence. So, teamwork makes the dream work, and we're here to inspire your next collaborative breakthrough. Gather your team or put on your headphones, and let's dive in together.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name is Dane Groeneveld, and today I'm joined by Dr. Vijay Pendekar. Vijay is the author of The Alchemy of Talent. It's his second book and a bestseller. And he's also the founder of Vijay Pendekar Consulting. So I'm excited to dive into this story. We've already got warmed up today in the pre-show, and there's a lot of energy. So welcome, Vijay.
I'm super excited to be here, Dane.
Me too. So tell us a bit more about you. How did you come to be doing all this cool work?
Well, I got really interested in human performance, primarily because of my personal and visceral encounter with underperformance. My parents are immigrants from India, and I grew up in Chicago. The place they could afford to buy a house was a very underserved community at the northern edge of the city. And I grew up with fantastic, hardworking families and young children that were deeply impacted by an ecosystem of the crack epidemic in the 1980s, the rise of gang violence, gun violence, mass incarceration, extraordinary joblessness and hopelessness. And by the time I graduated high school, I had had so many painful and frustrating experiences in my own life and with the kids around me, with the young people around me, of like input, great human, output, bad outcomes. And I didn't have any of the science and the training, but I was like, something is wrong here. Like something is really wrong here. And so when I went to college, it led me into being very curious about the relationship between humans and their environment and how the environment has an impact on their ability to do actual cognitive, physical, emotional work. And that got me a career, my first career. I've had a couple of different seasons of life, as I think many of us on the call can relate to. And I spent my first 18 years after college working at five different universities. I have a PhD, I'm trained as a social scientist, and really on student experience design. So how do we look at learning environments as a complex ecosystem of inputs and outputs and alter those environments to increase human performance, because there's all of these design barriers to people actually cognitively showing up and doing their best work. And so after moving around the country and pursuing that and writing my first book and having a family and all of these things, you know, just growing up, and I changed careers and took that body of skills and work into employee experience design. So I shifted into executive roles in HR. And I moved into three different software companies: Zynga, VMware, and Dropbox. And so these are all large, complex, global organizations with a focus on how people perform at work. And what happened over the course of those years is really me looking at teams, because I realized that the team is the micro ecosystem that I have more levers to pull on. And I'm super practical, as just like my orientation is like, if it gets too abstract or hand wavy, I get frustrated, I check out, you know. So I was managing my own attention, my own attention span issues. And so like the team felt like, well, this is the unit of performance, right? In any organization that has more than 300 or 400 people, teams make the difference. And it's, we would notice that you could take these really high performing ICs and put them on a dysfunctional team, and 2 + 2 = 1.5.
Yeah.
You know, so if we can fix the team dynamic, then magic can happen. And so, you know, a couple of years ago when I launched my own consultancy, I was like, what am I most experienced in, excited about, and that the world needs? And I tried to like triangulate on those three things, and building a body of work and doing work with complex organizations on what are the fastest ramps we have to increase team effectiveness, resilience, and agility became the core of my practice. And the subject of the book, The Alchemy of Talent.
That's awesome. I'm so energized. It's interesting that you mentioned the team as a unit of performance. I've been saying the team's a unit of measure. But where I look at it is, can you measure through a team what level of human connection, energy, innovation is going to happen? And I'd never thought about it in the way that you framed it, which is as a micro ecosystem, there's levers that you can pull in a team that, you know, you can't always move quickly enough in a larger org, or in fact, you can't afford to risk the disruption of doing some of that piloting and experimentation.
Yes. So I'll just riff off of what you're saying, right?
Yeah.
So there's this risk aversion, right, that I think is in organizations for good reason, right? And we're managing mission critical and high risk processes. We have these audacious revenue goals to hit. Everybody's under a ton of pressure. And the risk aversion creates a couple of different cognitive biases. One, we continue to do things that aren't working, even when we know they're not working. Right.
Yeah.
So this is like Thomas Kuhn's famous quote on paradigms, right? Like we continue to exist in the old paradigm, even after disruption has rendered it irrelevant.
Yeah.
And so there's the risk aversion that lends us to go back to what we were doing. And that's a huge issue I encounter with my clients right now. The unwillingness to pilot at scale is another risk aversion that I understand, but I think actually I would reframe, Dane, around the opportunity with teams is that so much of what has to happen is contextual to the team dynamic. So for example, when we talk about behaviors, sticky behaviors, right? And behaviors that actually unlock connection, belonging, which then generate agility and resilience, how that behavior surfaces on the finance team versus a tech and product team may look very different.
Yep.
So, you know, centrally directed strategies have to have extraordinarily locally contextualized tactics. And the team actually is the context. So if a team wants to commit to a behavior around productive conflict or continuous feedback, the look and feel of that behavior can really radically differ on the software team versus the HR team.
That's brilliant. I just want to play back those cognitive biases. So you said it's doing things that don't work. And it's this, you know, unwillingness to pilot at scale. Diving into that first one, doing things that don't work. I had a guest on the show recently, Mary Ciani, and she was sharing, and I'll add it to the show notes, the actual author of this work, that said that when you're in that moment of change, before it described a trapeze artist. So when you're leaving one bar, you can't let go of that bar until you've got your hand on the next one. And I think that's why so many teams just hold on to bad practices, is like, we haven't designed the new practice, so we can't let go of this. And there's no one's having that conversation about, well, who's responsible for designing the new bar and when's it going to show up? And it's really interesting what causes us to be stuck in teams. So I just love that kind of visualization.
I use the visualization of the trapeze act slightly differently. And so I'll share it for our listeners, right, to see what lands for them. I love the idea that you really have to make the next bar tangible. And I'll say some things about the next bar in a second. But often in a trapeze act, what you see in high-level trapeze work is that you actually let go of one bar and you're in free fall for a second before you grab the next bar.
Oh.
So if you pay the big bucks for the Cirque du Soleil show, right, they're actually doing some moves actually in free fall. And what I am seeing in the workforce right now is that I think that we're in high ticket Cirque du Soleil trapeze, because we've got 5 years of carryover debt of burnout, overwhelm, and sort of crispiness in the human condition. Yeah. And we are loading more business transformations than ever before. There's good data. I just got back from the Chief Transformation Officers Exchange in Chicago, and transformation officers were sharing that their enterprise organizations were loading between 50 to 150 business transformation initiatives simultaneously. So if you think about these as twin frictions, we've got the friction of existing burnout and overwhelm, and the friction of incredible breadth and depth of business transformation change. I actually think that the analogy becomes that Cirque du Soleil move, where we're asking the workforce to literally exist in free fall and trust that the next bar is coming. And the word trust becomes paramount then, right? So many of when I go in and they and I'm working with a executive that says, like, where do we even get started, Vijay? Almost always right now, I say probably on trust, because the dynamics of trust, even if you have led a high-performing organization and you care about your people and, like, it's a values-based company, trust is beat up status quo right now. And so the leap of faith it takes to undergo the level of movement into the uncertainty of 2025 that we're asking from humans right now is analogous to, no, you got to let go of one bar. The next bar is not even here yet. And you can really play this out with AI toolage to AI tool sets and AI adoption. There's this, you know, there's all this research coming out now that the AI spend and the AI impact are really asymmetric.
Far apart.
And like 70, 80% of these initiatives are failing. And it's because we actually don't have the right framework in place to understand that we've over-indexed on plans and processes, and we have not brought the people along. And the people actually need a harness on them so that they can hang in there and grab that next bar. So we've got all kinds of metaphors going here, I know, but
this,
like,
is awesome.
That harness actually, for me, has been a powerful way as a storyteller for change to help leaders understand that there's something tangible to do here. We got to give people a harness, and that's behavioral.
Yeah. I love the harness. My challenge with the harness, though, if they're doing 50 to 150 transformations, we're not just asking that that acrobat to let go of one bar and grab the next one. We're asking them to let go, cut themselves in three, and grab three different bars going in different directions. Yeah. Like, how do you put a harness on one person to go and do three different things at once?
Oh, I mean, this is what I was thinking about when I was in Chicago, right? The sage wisdom would be, we need to slow down the rate of change now, but that's just not going to go anywhere. So in the face of not being able to control the elephant in the room, which is we may be attempting too much change at the same time, what is good guidance, right? And so that means that in the behavioral space, when we do get into team dynamics, we actually have to go with less is more. So what are the minimum viable behaviors we're going to ask people to adopt that have the biggest multiplier effect on trust, resilience, and agility? Because if the behavioral playbook looks as complex and overwrought as the business transformation roadmap, we're cooked. Yeah. We're cooked. People are going to be like, it's like when you go to the grocery store and you're supposed to buy pasta sauce and there's 7,000 pasta sauces and you walk out of there without any pasta sauce, or you just buy the last pasta sauce you bought, even though you weren't even happy with it.
Infinite browsing mode.
Yes. Yes. Choice paradox. Like, yeah. All this stuff. Right. Stuck. I mean, it's just, so we have to reduce the complexity here, and there's good razors to do that with.
Yeah. That's very cool. I'm excited to dive into that some more today. And then you also talked to, you know, with this unwillingness to pilot at scale, it sounds like there's good reason, because if, as you suggest, that you can't roll out a one size fits all, even if a behavior looks very different between the finance and the engineering functions, that's a problem.
That's right. So one example I have of trying to do this better, right? And I really put the emphasis on try, because anytime we're talking about pilot and innovation, I want to name, right, that this is about iteratively stumbling towards better. And so I did one advisory strategy consulting role recently, where we put together a human-centered design unit with some real expertise in what's called human-centered design, which is you're studying the problem of what's not working on a team. And we would look at like a larger team, like a business unit with like, let's say 100, 150 key salespeople that are really at the forefront of transformation, need to learn new things. And there's some funkiness, to be technical about it, right? It's not hot and pop in the way we want it to be. And so by embedding experienced designers to study the problem, what we would do then is micropilot quick behavioral interventions. So this is a process, right? But then if you think about how do we go from the local to the universal, we tried this thing called postcards from the field. And we would send out these, you know, digital postcards to the broader enterprise from the sites of piloting around early signals that we were seeing about what may be sticking, what may be working, without saying immediately go and do this. But what we were saying is we are learning in this 100,000 person organization. We're embedded with these 150 people, but here's what we're seeing very quickly, week over week, as possible leverage points on behavioral change. And the postcards from the field helped shine a bat signal towards, like, for the rest of the enterprise that, like, pull some of these postcards into your space. Don't do them. There's no lift and shift. You know what I mean? Take it in, digest it, and put it into play in your context, because it's going to take this design team time to circle around to your business unit. In order to try and serve the enterprise while acknowledging that context is everything, these kinds of dynamic engines between iterative design sites and messaging campaigns with early learnings can actually evangelize a form of experimentation that is meaningful to the enterprise.
That's brilliant. And it reminds me, I love to read a lot about history. It reminds me of, like, it's a pattern we've already used. Like, I love the choice of the word postcard. Once upon a time, I read that book, Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond.
So
great
good.
Great book.
So good.
And it's like, once upon a time, the way that technology was adopted was that a traveler would come through with a bag of seeds or a book or some story that you know, that local community could learn from around a campfire and maybe start to borrow from. And then they emerge their own version of it, and it kind of goes on, and it is very, I love the choice of words there as well around, like, stumble towards better. Mm. Like, don't try and design the heck out of it.
Yeah.
Let the best of the teams that are in place kind of bring forth what's meaningful to them.
Just it was something that sparked for me when you were saying that about travelers and then gathering around the campfire and saying, like, we have these seeds as a way of evangelizing technology, right? A friend of mine and I talk a lot about parenting. We both have young children, and he's very embedded in ecosystem design from a permaculture perspective. So he works on the land, and he has a lot of training in indigenous permaculture technologies. So how did indigenous people manage land? It's very different than how we manage land right now. I think everybody on the call probably knows that. But one of the things he was sharing around learning through play is there are some really powerful examples in specific indigenous communities of when they want children to learn something new, they would bring the thing out into the common area of where the tribal community was hanging out during the day, and the adults would actually play with the tools, and the kids would watch for a little bit, right? So the adults would play with the game or the tools or use the tools, and then they'd drop everything and walk away.
Intentionally.
Yes. So there isn't a didactic moment. There's a demonstration of one way of doing it. And then kids would just jump in, and kids just start messing with stuff. But you've given them some sense of how these things may be used. But actually, kids are going to get there in a dynamic approach, right? And so I'll append this with a modern story. So I was participating in a team builder where I was a participant. I love getting to be a participant, because when you're a full-time facilitator, it's such a treat to participate. And it was a competitive team builder with a bunch of teams. And people have probably done this one. It's the spaghetti and marshmallows tower building one, where every team has 20 or 25 pieces of uncooked spaghetti and, you know, 8 to 10 marshmallows. And you have 5 minutes on the clock to build the tallest tower possible. And we actually had somebody on our team who was an engineer. And so everybody's, like, gathered around our little table, and we're like, how do we do this? You know, is it Is it the triangle? Is it the arch? I heard there was this bridge that was built in this one way, and everybody starts like theorizing, right? Because we're all mid-40s, mid-50s executives, right? Yeah. And this guy goes, hey, I just want to give you a tip. I actually know how to win this game. And we're all like, what is it? And he goes, children win this game over adults all the time. And we're like, really? And he goes, yeah, because they just start building. They don't actually think about it. They all just grab spaghetti and marshmallows and start jamming. And he goes, we're going to run out of time. The game is designed to make you run out of time. So the team that starts building fastest just wins.
Yeah.
We were all like, you know, and so let's loop this back, right? So what's the so what for team effectiveness or the future of teamwork, right? I think there's so much we know about how children learn, and we somehow, and I saw this because I worked with college students and then I worked with adults and I was a child and now I'm a parent. And we have these weird swim lanes where we're like, oh, this is how children learn. And then we ditch all of that for college. Already in college, we stop actually using experiential learning, play-based learning, all of this stuff that like works for kids. And we need it back in college. And then we continue to get even worse with adults. If you look at learning management systems, LMSs, how many LMSs are just chock full of these long asynchronous learning journeys that are like dopamine killers?
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, and why, nobody learns like this. It's unsexy, it's unsticky, you know? And so that we have this incredible body of research and science that is just like, if you have children in your life, pull forward into what you are doing with your team and you're already in a better place.
That's so cool. That's super energizing too. And it takes away the onus on the leader to go out and bring the consulting firm in and build the culture book or do the big piece of work. It's like you can get started now and you can start enjoying some experience. And actually, you probably have less of a change management challenge on your hands if you're actually involving and including your team in this kind of journey of learning at this moment in time.
Yeah.
That's cool. I'm energized by that. I love how it ties back to your early story about, you know, living in an underserved community and realizing that even with great people, if they don't have the right environment to be doing the cognitive, emotional, physical work, that, you know, it brings bad outcomes no matter how good you put the inputs in at the top.
Yeah.
What have you seen as you do this work, Vijay, on you know, a team or an organization, and they start developing these great behaviors and practices, they're building resilience and agility. What are you seeing going the other way? Like, the parent can bring the play to work, but what are the employees then taking back to their families and communities when this starts to work well?
I often find myself in workshops when I'm like really in it with a group, you know, like less so on a stage or in a formal sort of kind of podcast setting, but when I'm, you know, we're in a couple hours of a workshop, there's often moments where I just say like, look, this is a human skill, right? So for example, when I'm talking about micro behaviors that scaffold towards resilience, I'm using the science of belonging, right? And there's all of these micronutrients in belonging that teams can adopt quickly. And high belonging teams are able to do hard things for longer periods of time, right? That's why belonging is your source code for human resilience. And so when we get into the behaviors that scaffold towards more team resilience, there's one of them that I call naming the North Star. And this is about helping the team understand through direct lines how their work contributes to the bigger win. Yeah. And this is a very classic fundamental leadership skill that I think a lot of people know. And then it slips off the edge of the desk as we get disrupted and our nervous systems get activated. So we're in this low level fight, flight, freeze all the time. And so the fundamental of, hey, when you are speaking to your team, the greater the uncertainty and volatility, the more frequently we have to name the North Star. And that means you have to draw a straight line from the work of this team to the big win of the organization so that people can have a sense of why in their work and their pride goes up. Oh, okay. This toil that I'm working on, you're not telling me it's good because it meets the OKR. Frankly, that's way too, you know, like that's meeting abstract, the OKR. Yeah. Right. And so when we're talking through this, I'll often you know, as people are practicing naming the why, we'll do some role playing. And I'm like, think about this at home, right? Like when you're trying to say to the kids, at the end of dinner, we all need to bring our dishes over to next to the sink and we're going to take some different roles here. There's a couple of different ways of doing this. There's the 1980s parenting way I grew up with, which is you got to do these jobs, right? You want to eat, you know what I mean? Or you can also start talking about like, we're a family. And so part of what it means to be a functional family is that we're all actually contributing in these small ways to making dinner time a success. And when dinner time's a success, we actually get to play one round of Uno after dinner because we got through the cleanup more quickly. And so what's happening there? I'm bundling in something that's hedonistic, right? That's pleasurable into the idea. If you commit to the behavior, now even with the North Star, we also want to bundle in some satisfaction, right? And so the same thing shows up at work, right? Like when people engage in the behaviors that you want them to, you also have to feather in some regular hedonic hits. Because ultimately, we are all self-interested, you know, animals. We're pro-social, self-interested animals that need some immediate gratification. And so for leaders, when we talk about this, we talk about minimum viable behaviors that are necessary to get you to the team that is more resilient and more agile. And then how do we feather in the hedonic hits, and so or the dopamine hits, if the word hedonic is not landing for you, right? And so then how do we bring in the micro rituals of recognition? How do we bring in the science of novelty? And I'm happy to speak to either of those if you think that, you know, like that's something that your audience would want to hear about.
Oh, totally. I'm just struggling to work out how we're going to fit it all into the conversation. But like, Where does, you know, science of novelty plays out to me. I love to bring play and unstructured time to my team. So maybe you can dive in there
Yeah, this is something I talk about in the book. So, you know, I have a whole chapter on team connection. What we know about the variable of the connected team is a highly connected team is able to remain coherent under the fracturing pressure of repeated disruption. So when I'm talking to a chief cybersecurity officer or a business unit leader that leads a complex major P&L, and I say, hey, tell me about volatilities over the last year. And they're like, where do I even get started? Like we pivoted, you know? And then I'm like, okay, so do we have some incoherence in your teams? And I'll ask some tuning questions, and there's incoherence abound, right? You know? And so when we're looking at the recipe for team connection, there are so many things to do. But when we go through the tactics of task hygiene, who's doing what, you know, priority stacking, buying back role clarity, there's all these connection rituals that are about the work. We also need to layer in something that brings the neurochemical benefit of high levels of connection. And so I tell leaders, you have this incredible low or no budget tool that is the science of novelty. And novelty is when you make tasks less familiar and a little bit more challenging. So moderate challenge, low familiarity. So we can take something like having to do some strategic planning and first do an ideation hackathon. Why are hackathons so attractive? Because they bring an element of play, right? Which is lower familiarity, moderate challenge into the work, right? Or when leaders say, look, Vijay, I really want to reward my team. And so we have to do all this hard work, but I was thinking about going out and taking them out to a nice dinner on Friday night. And what I write about in the book is nice dinners are actually not novel. Because at some point in our life, we have all had the steak with the truffle butter. And I love truffle butter, I really love truffle butter, but it's not novel. It's actually quite familiar. So you can take that same budget of taking 10 people to the steakhouse and go do an escape room or axe throwing or collaborative problem solving or puzzle of some kind, and then go to a medium dinner, $2 signs on Yelp, and have just as much fun and get a way better outcome around the way the team feels in their closeness to each other, because teams that do novel things actually generate these plexes, which are the behavioral scientist term for connective tissues. And it comes from having gone through common experiences.
gone through calm experiences.
Common experiences. So
common experiences. Oh, so it's the epiphany effect.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I have a propensity to like to dress up in costumes. So where does that fit into the novelty?
I mean, I think it's like if you've ever seen the recommendation for a busy executive that you should reduce choice fatigue by wearing the same clothes every day. Have you ever seen this?
Yeah, Steve Jobs kind of vibe.
There's a huge problem with this in that you're taking away a low friction form of creative expression that for some people could actually be very life-giving, right? So I don't know why you're dressing up in costume. Maybe you're a live action role player and there's an Arthurian or Lord of the Rings side of your life that we need to know more about, Dane. There's just a part of you that's like, oh, God, Wednesday. But today, if I actually like do this with my clothing, it just gives me this minor bit of like gamification to my morning that gives me a little bump, right? A pleasure chemical bump. That's a daily form of resilience building, right? That helps us continue to stay engaged and focused and alive and vibrant in a hard time. So
I love that.
Yeah.
And how does Vanessa Van Edwards talks to like the way that we smile can be contagious and other human behaviors can be contagious in groups. So I'm hearing that the common experience creates the connective tissue, but how does a leader showing up, you know, with a bit of novelty kind of connect and become contagious in teams? Is there anything there that you see?
Yeah, absolutely. So the word contagious is so powerful because it cuts both ways. So what we need to first establish is a floor on harm reduction. And I always help leaders understand that if you permit bad behavior, you actually are opening the door to emotional contagion. One person on an 8 to 10 person team that is consistently negative or toxic or mean or, you know, sociopathic or whatever, right, can legitimately drag the entire team down because as pro-social animals, we take our emotional cues from the people around us. It's the adage of like, well, just ignore them. It doesn't work that way because we are actually hardwired over hundreds of thousands of years of brain evolution to be very receptive to the nervous system of the group.
Yeah.
And so our nervous systems co-regulate through visual cues and also energetic cues with the people around us.
Wow.
And that first we have to understand through a harm reduction lens, because oftentimes teams are really in the dip right now, Dane. And so I always start with like, look, we got to get unstuck first. And that means limiting emotional contagion, bad actors, right? All that kind of stuff. But then when you're going good to great and you're hitting ignition, right? We also need to understand that this powerful tool of the fact that we co-regulate with the people around us can be leveraged for positive virality. And so where do you get started? Well, one of the things I read about on the book is creating a viral culture of healthy vulnerability. So when we know that human connection requires reasonable amounts of vulnerability on the team, and that this is actually dovetailed to psychological safety and trust and positive risk-taking that builds towards innovation, right? So for the business leaders on the call, if vulnerability makes you feel like, are we getting fluffy? Understand the chain of events here, right? If you want a team that innovates consistently, then when you work backwards the signal chain, you need a team that's willing to take risks without fear of shame or punishment. And the team that can take risks without fear of shame or punishment has incredible trust. So what do we know about establishing robust trust is that you actually have to have a team that can be vulnerable. And so vulnerability is not feel-good culture fluff. It is one of the catalysts to generate healthy risk-taking and unlock innovation. And so how do we get started? Leaders go first. I borrowed this term from Daniel Coyle. Shout out to his incredible book, The Culture Code. But leaders have to go first because leaders set the ceiling on vulnerability for the team. When leaders say to the team, hey, look, Dane, I want you to know that you can take risks on this team. And I want you to know this is a place you can be a fuller human and all that stuff. I understand we're all people, but you never do any of that. The team's going, okay, Vijay, all right, I see you, right? Your behavior is the signal, not your words, right? You know, like yes. what yeah, I mean,
absolutely.
Right? Not your virtue signaling. So So what do? You actually do what you're talking about. You actually kick off. If you want novelty, then you can say, look, we're going to do a little team game. I'm actually building it into every other Monday morning stand-up, and it's going to be on the agenda. And the game is called Road Trip Questions. And these are, I pulled 20 of these from a Google search. And these are like wacky questions that I think are just funny and spicy. And it's just 5 minutes, right? And these are just quick ways for us to be sharing. We run a hybrid or remote team, and we don't get the serendipity chances in office to do this. So I'm bringing serendipity into our meeting, right? Or one that I write about in the book is called Wired, Tired, and Inspired, right? So this is actually, I think, a really important ritual for teams that are remote or hybrid that are really feeling the weathering effect of repeated disruptions and uncertainties, which is probably most teams these days, is that you have to create a forcing function for people to bring a little bit more of themselves to work, because it sets up this amazing flywheel. So a ritual like Wired, Tired, and Inspired, which is everybody goes around the circle and just shares something they're excited about, wired, something that's dragging them down this week, tired, and something they're really looking forward to out on the horizon, you know, then what it does is later in the week, if I'm on your team, Dane, and I remember your Wired, Tired, and Inspired sharing from Monday, and I go, hey, Dane, you were sharing about how excited you were for your kid's little league game. How did the game go?
Brilliant. Yeah.
What's happening? We're giving permission for people to be human with each other, because I can follow up on something you shared. And what this does is it increases your sense of mattering. And I'm totally dropping this nugget for you, because I know how into mattering you are, right?
Oh yeah, I'm big on mattering.
Right. First step in mattering is you have to make people feel seen. How do you make people feel seen if you don't know anything about them? So like, there's a logic model for all of this that really defies the kind of skepticism around feel good culture and really brings all of this into performance science.
Yes. I love that. The Wired, Tired, Inspired, I like too, because if I'm hearing it right, you're not dictating that it needs to be work-related. So someone could bring work, but someone totally could bring the Little League game.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And if you, and there, you know, like for teams that are like, look, this is all about work, and that's okay, right? You know, there's cultures where that maybe that's more normal. You know, like I still say that the logic model is you create the minimum viable bucket of habits that your team needs, and then you create rituals to make them sticky and adoptable. And so rituals are the delivery vector for habits to become repeated and then eventually just grow into the muscle fiber of how the team operates. So almost all teams nowadays need a recognition ritual that is frequent and specific. And I write about this in the book, is the science of frequent and specific recognition and how it builds this durable sense of belonging. And so I talk about one, you know, I mean, people can repurpose this in any way they want, but just having people go, oh, I know that recognition matters, and we've got an end of year banquet for that. We need frequent pats on the back in this environment. Actually, always humans do. If you said, oh, I have children in my life, and once a year I say that they are doing a good job, you would be like, you know, worst parent of the year, right? So like, same thing with adults, like, so how do you ritualize it? 5 minutes of fame is a ritual you inject 5 minutes into your stand-up. It's on the agenda. Put it on the agenda. Doesn't have to be every time, but maybe it's every second time or every third time. And it's just, it's a round robin, and people can shout out each other's work. You unmute, hey, I want to shout out. Last week, I was stuck on this big problem, and Dane actually stayed after and helped me solve this problem. And I delivered, and I closed the deal with a client. You know what I mean? Like, and that kind of popcorn-style lateral culture of frequent and specific recognition creates this incredible engine of resilience for the team.
Yeah. And it's specific, so important too. Because if it's just like, hey, kudos to Lisa, she was really there for me last week when I was having a tough time. Yeah, exactly. I love the specificity.
Yeah.
I also like the way that you, in that particular ritual, make it a team sport, because I've got this friend who really struggles with giving people positive feedback in the moment. And so if anyone else has one of those friends, then making it a team sport, like, it kind of just gets the reps in, everyone else can be in, and then you can jump in, you know, off something. It gives you a way in if you're not someone who's like quick off the mark or comfortable with it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You know, and when I'm thinking about how we help people where they are, right? And rather than dealing in kind of mystical ideals, right? One of the things that I've worked really hard on over the past few months that I'm excited to share here is when I've met with so many executives and leaders over the past several years of working across Fortune 500s, global nonprofits. And one thing that seems universal is that people are like, I can't figure out how to codify where my team is in its evolution. Like, I need some kind of a journey map, right, for placing my team on the arc. And so something I'm super excited to share here is I built something called the Disruption Proof Team, and it's a maturity model, right? For the geeks on the call, a maturity model or like a stage model. And stage one is like when you are really in, you're in it, and it's called stuck. And stage five is disruption proof. This is the team where disruption actually makes the team better, right? And what the model is based on is super simple behavioral things. Rather than like you know, the kind of like McKinsey, massively complex heuristics, the model is basically in each stage, what are the behaviors of a team that's in that stage? And what are the teamwork foundations of a team in that stage? And what that means is role clarity, goal clarity, feedback cycles, effective meetings. That's it. And so for listeners, if you lead a team or if you're on a team, you can go to my website, vijaypendlecore.com, and right on the landing page, there's like a take a quiz. And you can answer, it takes 2 minutes, you answer 10 questions, and it shows you where you are on the disruption proof journey. And, cool. It solves all your problems, but at least it gives you a sense of like, here's where I am. At. And then how do I get to the next stage? And there's tons of tools and resources I have for that.
That's neat. I'm super excited for that. And disruption proof teams is so cool because it's not, I actually have a problem. I'd love your perspective on this, Vijay. I have a problem with high-performing teams because I see so many of them in a constant state of burnout and they're having terrible human outcomes. So I've been focusing on healthy teams as teams that can sustain performance. But disruption-proof, it's right on the money too because we're constantly living in this like anxiety-fueled world of change and disruption. So it's the way to go.
More power to you to just bring the word healthy into your lexicon in 2025. I love that. I mean, I got feedback from a leader a couple of months ago that I was working with, and I kept reflexively using the term high-performing teams because of the research that I do, right? And he was like, Vijay, I'm kind of getting stressed out by that language. And I was like, oh, tell me more. And he goes, if we work really hard, I want my team to become a well-performing team.
Like, yeah, yeah.
We've been in it, and so many things have happened that I feel like high-performing team is like, it's just too aspirational right now. So on the other side, right, there's this kind of like, you know, perfectionist burnout-y vibe around high-performing team. But on the other side, like telling people that they need to be in stage five all the time, it's just not realistic, right? Like what about the reality that we probably are oscillating somewhere between stage two and stage four in a good moment all the time, right? And even in stage journeys that are about personal development, you can't tell me you just made it to the top of the mountain, right? it's an oscillation, right? And these are spectrums, not destinations.
And I think people also need to realize with their top performers, top performing teams, is that most mountain climbers die on the way down the hill, not on the way up. So once you've come through that moment, that you need to really be thinking about recovery and where next and how next. Because it's real.
That is a powerful metaphor. I had not heard that before. I might have to steal that and cite Dane every time I use
that's it. or the white spider or wherever I read it.
Okay. According to the white spider.
Well, that's neat. Well, man, it's been an absolute blast. I feel like we could have talked all day. I love how you started out with the origin story about, you know, your environment growing up and seeing, you know, that opportunity to do good work is really what brings out the flourishing in people and in teams. The shift from like student experience design to employee experience design and pretty hard charging software businesses is super cool just to get that kind of bearing on where you've seen some of these behaviors and approaches to team effectiveness play out. And the book, so The Alchemy of Talent, sounds like you've designed some very like practical, like go get started now elements. I love the way you shared like, hey, children win at these games because they just start by building and learn as they go. So there's so much value there. I've taken tons of value away. I think the other big one I took was that, you know, don't design behaviors for all. Like, you know, set the behavior and let each team and function design what that is for them at their time.
That's right.
And their preference.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great synopsis. You know, I'd say for people who want to dive into the book, it is very actionable. It's fun. It's under 150 pages because I don't think we need the 300 page tome anymore. Every 2 to 3 pages, there's an activity, and everything ends in behavioral steps you can take starting tomorrow. And then if you read the book and you're like, where is my team on the journey? You can take the quiz on my website, vijaypendekar.com.
That's awesome. Well, I was going to ask, where do we find you? You've just shared it. So we'll put that in the links.
Or you can come to Austin and we can grab some barbecue and whiskey, which is what I offered you before we started recording today.
I'm going to go and look at my Southwest flights soon.
Yes.
Well, it's been awesome. Thanks so much for the time today. And I look forward to continuing the collaboration.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure, Dane.
Thanks, Vijay.